Welcome back to McClanahan Academy's United States History, 1865 the present. We got our reading presentations. This is reading presentation one. We're going to focus on, just like in the first half of the course, or if you haven't taken that yet, I give these particular seminars, about 20 minutes. We'll talk about the reading material that I assign to you. A lot of it's going to be primary documents, but some of it won't be. So I want to go over this material with you and help explain some of the important concepts to get out of the material, what you should understand with this material, why it's important, how it applies to the class or the unit that you're studying, so that you can gain a fuller understanding. A lot of times, again, it's going to be primary documentation. So it might be a speech, it might be a newspaper account, something that has to do with that particular time period. And again, that applies to the unit that we're studying. So, in this first unit, we're going to look at two speeches, or at least portions of two speeches, or one set of resolutions, I should say, and a speech, and then also a part of a Supreme Court decision. And this all has to do with Reconstruction. Now, again, this one unit on Reconstruction, I mentioned this earlier on this unit, this one unit on Reconstruction, I've got a whole course on Reconstruction where I get into a lot more detail with some things. So, you could use that as a better, for a more full understanding of Reconstruction. But here, I want to focus on these three documents, and they're actually all by Republicans. I didn't use anything in these documents that would deal with the opposition, but I wanted to talk about the legal and intellectual basis of radical Reconstruction of the South. And then I want to talk about in the one document that has the Supreme Court decision. That's a very important document dealing with the interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And this is from the Slaughterhouse cases. So I didn't get into the Slaughterhouse cases in the unit. I do a lot more with that in my two classes, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America and also the American Constitutions course. But I wanted to explain the Slaughterhouse cases, or at least the dissent, and what one judge said about these things. So it's not that this is the final opinion on this, but I think that it's important, or at least this was the majority, part of the majority opinion, I should say. It was important to understand how the legal reasoning the Supreme Court justices at the time used in their decision on the Slaughterhouse cases and the wide-ranging impact that should have on American jurisprudence, but it doesn't. So let's get into these. First and foremost, we've got the Charles Sumner state suicide theory. Now, this comes from the Congressional Globe, February 11th, 1862. So here we are, 1862. I mentioned that Reconstruction actually begins in 1862. We've got Lincoln's amnesty proclamation, but we also have, which comes out a little bit after this, also we've got a real plan for the future of the United States being developed by the Republican Party. And Charles Sumner believed, and I mentioned this in the lectures, that the states committed suicide when they seceded from the United States. And he says so. These are a series of resolutions. And if you look at the first series of first resolution, resolved that any vote of secession or other act by which any state may undertake to put an end to the supremacy of the Constitution within its territory is inoperative and void against the Constitution. And when sustained by force, it becomes a political abdication by the state of all rights under the Constitution, while the treason which it involves still further works an instant forfeiture of all those functions and powers essential to the continued existence of the state as a body politic. So that from the time forward, the territory falls under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Congress as other territory, and the state being accorded to the language of the law, filo di se ceases to exist. So, his premise is that because these states agreed to an ordinance of secession, they are no longer a state, and that they will be governed by the United States. Now, this is an interesting position because essentially what Sumner is laying out here is that the Congress can say when a state ceases to exist. This is upending the entire history of the United States. And it's upending the entire history of the United States because the states created the central government. and the central government had no role in determining other than admitting new states when a state was not a state or a state was a state. They could admit states, but they didn't get to say you are or you are not a state. Only the people of the states could do that, as John C. Calhoun pointed out with the state of Michigan. And of course, the fact is, these states, through conventions of popularly elected delegates, seceded in larger crushing majorities than what agreed to ratify the Constitution or supported the American War for Independence. So this is a unique position and will be buttressed by Thaddeus Stevens in the next talk. But so he says, because they had an ordinance of secession, they are now no longer states. They've abdicated their powers as states. But of course, they're not part of the Union anymore. But of course, he says that they've committed treason. And the supremacy of the Constitution. There's no supremacy of the Constitution in regard to many of the issues that the states were dealing with. So there's a whole lot of legal mumbo jumbo going on in this first resolution. Now, resolve that any combination of men assuming to act in the place of such states and attempting to ensnare or coerce the inhabitants thereof into a confederation hostile to the Union is rebellious, treasonable, and destructive of all moral authority. And that such combination is a usurpation incapable of any constitutional existence and utterly lawless, so that everything dependent upon it is without constitutional legal support. This is the kind of language that people use nowadays to say, I mean, they're basically echoing Charles Sumner, which was not the decided opinion of the day. It was Charles Sumner's opinion. But there are many other people that didn't think this was the case. Resolved that the termination of a state under the Constitution necessarily causes the termination of those peculiar local institutions which, having no origin in the Constitution or in those natural rights which exist independent of the Constitution, are upheld by the sole and exclusive authority of the state. So here he's getting at slavery. He's driving home that because the states are no longer states, that slavery is now abolished. And he says that slavery being a peculiarly local institution derived from local laws without any origin in the Constitution or natural rights is upheld by the sole and exclusive authority of the state and must therefore cease to exist legally or constitutionally when the state on which it depends no longer exists, for the incident cannot survive the principle. So Sumner is outlining here that, look, because of your state suicide, slavery has also ceased to exist in these states. This is long before the Emancipation Proclamation, which of course didn't abolish slavery, or the 13th Amendment. But he's saying because these states, we can do what we want with slavery now because the states don't exist anymore. Now, this is also a unique argument with the Constitution, primarily because he says this doesn't originate in the Constitution. He's correct about that. Slavery is not mentioned in the Constitution, but it is protected by the Constitution. He does, by default, recognize that when he says, look, it's protected by the states. Also, we do know that the Fugitive Slave Clause is there, and so there are some things by the Constitution that does protect slavery, but he's saying because these states are no longer states, there's no protection of slavery. Now, he concludes his last resolution, says this, that the duty directly cast upon Congress by extinction of the states is reinforced by the positive prohibition of the Constitution that, quote, no state shall enter in any confederation or without the consent of Congress keep troops or ships of war in time of peace or enter in any agreement or compact with another state or grant letters of marque and reprisal or without the consent of Congress lay any duties, imposts or exports, all of which have been done by these pretended governments and also by the positive injunction of the Constitution addressed to the nation that the United States shall guarantee every state in this union republican form of government. That in pursuance of this duty cast upon Congress and further enjoined by the Constitution, Congress will assume complete jurisdiction of such vacated territory where such unconstitutional illegal things have been attempted and will proceed to establish their republican forms of government under the Constitution, and in the execution of this trust will provide carefully for the protection of all the inhabitants thereof, for the security of families, the organization of labor, the encouragement of industry, and the welfare and society, etc., etc. So this is the typical argument against secession that Article 1, Section 9 says the states can't do this, but of course, it's only if they're in the Union. So the argument begins with secession never really happened. It didn't legally happen, so this can't be going on, which we know it did happen. It legally happened. And so, but that's Sumner's argument. So this is why he believes that the Congress can take over these states. And Thad Stevens concurs. He says this is December 18th, 1865. So he says the president assumes that no one doubts that the late rebel states have lost their constitutional relations to the Union and are incapable of representation in Congress, except by permission of the government. It matters but little with his admission whether you call them states out of the Union and now conquered territories, or assert that because the Constitution forbids them to do what they do, that they are therefore only dead as to all national political action, and remain so until the government shall breathe into them the breath of life anew and prevent them to occupy their former position. In other words, they are not out of the Union, but are dead carcasses lying within the Union. So this is what he's saying. Again, it's these states committed suicide. They're now dead carcasses. Now, a state can't happen. The general government does not breathe life into the states. It works the other way around. But these people have flipped everything in the government is on its head. In either case, it is very plain that it requires the action of Congress to enable them to form a state government and send representative to Congress. Nobody, I believe, pretends that with their old constitutions and frames of government, they can be permitted to claim their old rights under the Constitution. They have torn their constitutional states into atoms and built on their foundation fabrics of a totally different character. They did? I don't think so. They were still the same states. He says, dead men cannot raise themselves. Dead states cannot restore their existence as it was. Whose a special duty is it to do it? And whom does the Constitution place the power? Not in the judicial branch of government, for only educates and does not prescribe laws. Not in the executive, for he only executes and cannot make laws. Not in the commander-in-chief of the armies, for he can only hold them under military rule until the sovereign legislative power of the conqueror shall give them law of the conqueror. Unless the laws of nations is a dead letter, the late war between two acknowledged belligerents severed the original compacts and broke all the ties that bound them together. That's actually interesting because he's saying that these were two belligerent powers, that they actually had a separate government. The future condition of the conquered power depends on the will of the conqueror. It must come in as new states remain as conquered provinces. Congress is the only power that can act in the matter. So this gets into this debate between the president and the Congress. And I actually believe that Stevens is more correct here than anything else. Of course, Lincoln would say, no, this is the executive power because he's commander-in-chief. Or he is the person who can best direct as the person who's involved in invading the South, essentially. He can best direct this. But I think Stevens actually makes a better case here for Congress. However, some of the things he says are just outrageous. Stevens is making a better logical and legal argument. Now, Congress alone can do it. Congress must create states and declare when they are entitled to be represented. Congress cannot create states. Then each house must judge whether the members presenting themselves form a recognized state possesses the requisite qualification of days, residence, quote unquote. He's trying to get into the fact that many people had shown up into the Congress from these former states and they wouldn't seat these people. And this is why he's doing it. So he goes on to say about these states, he says, they ought never to be recognized as capable of acting in the Union or of being counted as valid states until the Constitution have been so amended as to make it what its framers intended, and so as to secure perpetual ascendancy to the party of the Union, and so as to render our Republican government firm and stable forever. So he openly admits, he's saying, they're going to agree that the Republicans will be perpetual. The first of those amendments is to change the basis of representation among the states from federal numbers to actual voters. With the basis unchanged, the 83 Southern members, with the Democrats that will in the best times be elected from the North, will always give a majority in the Congress and the Electoral College. I need not depict the ruin that would follow. So he is pointing out, this is all about power and votes. I mean, Stevens admits it here, which is one of the keys to understanding Reconstruction. If you don't understand that, you don't really understand Reconstruction. But this is not all that we ought to do before the inveterate rebels are invited to participate in our legislation. We have turned or are about to turn loose 4 million slaves without a hut to shelter them or a cent in their pockets. The infernal laws of slavery have prevented them from acquiring an education, understanding the common laws of contract, or of managing the ordinary business of life. The Congress is bound to provide for them until they can take care of themselves. Again, we get into this later in the class, you know, the slaves in nothing but freedom. Stevens has recognized these people have no education, they don't have any property, they're nothing. I mean, so they can't do anything, and they don't know anything. Now, that would be considered racist today to say something like that, but this is what he's pointing out. This Congress is about, as I said, if we do not furnish them with homesteads and hedge them around with protective laws, if we leave them to the legislation of their late masters, we had better have left them in bondage. If we fail in this great duty now, when we have the power, we shall deserve and receive the execration of history and all of all future ages. So, saying, look, they'd be better in slavery if we don't provide for them, because at least in slavery they're provided for. So, this is an interesting speech. There's a lot of meat in this very short amount of stuff that I've given you here from Thad Stevens, the great commoner. We'll get into some of these issues later on during Reconstruction with the presentations on civil rights, which is way down the class. So look for that later on. But I want to go, finally, because of time, to the purpose of the 14th Amendment. This is opinion of Justice Samuel Miller, who's a Lincoln appointee. In effect, decides that the 14th Amendment does not limit the police powers of the states. And this is from the slaughterhouse cases. It's a very short part of his opinion, but I want to read this. Before the adoption of the recent amendments, almost the entire domain of the privileges and immunities of citizens of the states lay within the constitutional and legislative power of the states and without that of the federal government. Was it the purpose of the 14th Amendment by the simple declaration that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States to transfer the security and protection of all the civil rights which we have mentioned from the states to the federal government? And where is it declared that Congress shall have the power to enforce that article? Was it intended to bring within the power of Congress the entire domain of civil rights heretofore belonging exclusively to the states? Such a construction, he said, would constitute this court a perpetual censor upon all legislation of the states on the civil rights of their own citizens, with authority to nullify such as it did not approve as consistent with those rights as they existed at the time of the adoption of this amendment. The argument, we admit, is not always the most conclusive, which is drawn from the consequences urged against the adoption of a particular construction of an instrument. But when, as in the case before us, these consequences are so serious, so far-reaching and pervading, so great a departure from the structure and spirit of our institutions, when the effect is to fetter and degrade the state governments by subjecting them to control of Congress and the exercise of powers heretofore universally conceded to them of the most ordinary and fundamental character, when in fact it radically changes the whole theory of the relations of the state and federal governments to each other and of both these governments to the people, the argument has a force that is irresistible. We are convinced that no such results were intended by the Congress which proposed these amendments, nor by the legislatures of the states which ratified them. So essentially, Samuel Miller, who again is a Lincoln appointee, says there's no evidence that the 14th Amendment was designed to incorporate the Bill of Rights, that the Bill of Rights apply to the states, and we do not want Congress having a negative over the states. That was not intended by the original Constitution. It should not be intended now. So I love this decision because he is exactly right. If you go back and you look at the arguments and debates, Raoul Berger's done a very good job with this, but I mean, I've read them too. There are some people talking about that the amendment might do this, but that was explicitly rejected. And of course, the states never thought this was going to be the case when they ratified the 14th Amendment. Now, he does say that that this was supposed to protect former slaves, but no other minority groups. The 14th Amendment was supposed to protect former slaves, but no other minority groups. So it's a very interesting statement as well, considering the future of American government and society. But all of these pieces, again, very interesting to read. I expect you to read them and know them. These are good primary documents for diving into what's happening here in Reconstruction. Some of the points that are being made. We're going to do this again for the next unit, and I'll see you for that one.